Chapter 5. Miss had begun to cross the threshold that truly separates girlhood from womanhood now. She was enjoying an active social life and going off with her new friends, not all of them girls, on excursions to the mountains, to the deserts of the south, to the wilderness to the north. Her presence in the Martin household was becoming an increasingly rare event. So it was little Miss, not as little as before, who filled Andrew's horizon now. She was turning into a coltish, tireless girl who loved to run great distances along the beach, with Andrew effortlessly keeping pace beside her. She went rambling in the forested areas adjacent to the house, and relied on Andrew to help her down when she had scrambled a little too far up some tree to peer into a bird's nest, or when she had trapped herself on some precarious rocky ledge that she had climbed for the sake of getting a better view of the sea. As ever, Andrew was vigilant and endlessly protective as little Miss romped about. He would let her take her little tomboyish risks, yes, because they seemed to make her happy, but not without his calculating the real risk of anything serious happening to her, and he was always poised and ready to intervene swiftly on her behalf if that should be necessary. The first law, of course, compelled Andrew to exert constant diligence to protect little Miss from harm. But as he sometimes told himself, he would willingly and gladly defend her against peril of any sort if the first law did not exist. That was an odd thought, that there might be no first law. Andrew could barely conceive of that. The first law, and the second and the third, were such fundamental aspects of his neural pathways that it made him dizzy to imagine himself without them. And yet he had imagined it. Andrew was puzzled by that. How strange, having a capacity to imagine the unimaginable. It made him feel almost human when paradoxical concepts like that went through his mind. But what did almost human mean? That was another paradox, and an even more dizzying one. Either you were human or you were not. How could there be any sort of intermediate state? You are a robot, Andrew reminded himself sternly. You are a product of the United States Robots and Mechanical Men Corporation. And then Andrew would look at little Miss, and a sensation of great joy and warmth would spread through his positronic brain, a sensation that he had come to identify as love. And he would have to remind himself all over again that he was nothing more than a cleverly designed structure of metal and plastic with an artificial platinum iridium brain inside his chrome steel skull, and he had no right to feel emotions, or to think paradoxical thoughts, or to do any other such complex and mysterious human thing. Even his woodworking art, and he did allow himself to think of it as art, was simply a function of the skills with which he had been programmed by his designers. Little Miss never allowed herself to forget that the very first piece of wood carving Andrew had done had been for her. She was rarely without the little pendant that he had made for her out of that piece of driftwood, wearing it on a silver chain about her neck and reaching up to finger it fondly again and again. It was she who first objected to Sir's casual habit of giving away Andrew's productions to anyone who visited the house. He would proudly show his guests Andrew's latest work, and then, when the predictable expressions of admiration and even envy were uttered, would grandly exclaim, "Do you really like it that much? Then take it with you. By all means, take it. My pleasure. There are plenty more where that one came from." One day, Sir bestowed a particularly intricate abstract carving, a shining spheroid made of slender interwoven strips of redwood with inlays of manzanita and madrone wood, on the speaker of the legislature. The speaker was a loud-voiced, red-faced man who had always seemed particularly dull-witted and vulgar to little Miss, and she very much doubted that he had any possibility to see the beauty in Andrew's work. No doubt he was simply being diplomatic when he had praised the carving, and he would simply toss it thoughtlessly into some closet when he got it home. Little Miss said, after the speaker had left, "Come on, Dad. You shouldn't have given that to him, and you know it." "But he liked it, Mandy. He said he thought it was extremely beautiful."
"It is extremely beautiful."
Little Miss wondered why her father was sidestepping the issue like that. Sidestepping things wasn't normally part of his nature. And it wasn't as though anyone was likely to accuse him of deliberately setting out to earn money by peddling Andrew's work to his house guests. Obviously, Gerald Martin was in no need of picking up a bit of extra money on the side that way. But if the offers were made in good faith, though, why not accept them? She let the issue rest nevertheless. She knew her father well enough to understand that the matter was still open and would be attended to in due course. Then another visitor came, John Feingold, Sir's lawyer. The offices of Feingold's law firm were in the San Francisco area, where, despite the general decentralization of city life that had been going on all during the current century, a good many people still preferred to live. But though San Francisco was only a short journey south of the wild strip of coast where the Martins lived, a visit from John Feingold to the Martin house was a relatively unusual thing. Usually, Sir went down to San Francisco whenever he had business to discuss with Feingold, so Little Miss knew that something special must be up. Feingold was an easygoing, white-haired man with florid pink skin, a pudgy belly, and a warm, amiable smile. He preferred to dress in older styles of clothing, and the rims of his contact lenses were tinted a bright green, a fashion so rare nowadays that it was all that Little Miss could do to keep from giggling whenever she saw the lawyer. Sir had to shoot her a stern glance now and then when he detected a fit of laughter coming over her in Feingold's presence. Feingold and Sir settled down before the fireplace in the great central room of the house, and Sir handed him a small inlaid plaque that Andrew had produced a few days before. The lawyer nodded. He turned it over and over in his hand, rubbed its polished surface appreciatively, held it up to the light at various angles.
"Beautiful," he said finally. "Extraordinarily fine work, all right. Your robot did it?"
"Yes. How did you know that?"
"I've heard some talk. It's no secret, Gerald, that you've got a robot here who's a master craftsman in wood."
Sir glanced up at Andrew, who was standing quietly in the shadows to one side.
"Did you hear that, Andrew? You're famous all up and down California. But you're wrong about one thing, John. Andrew isn't simply a master craftsman. He's an out-and-out artist, nothing less."
"Indeed he is," Feingold said. "That's the only word for him. This is a wonderful piece."
"Would you like to own it?" Sir asked. Feingold's eyes widened in surprise.
"Are you offering it to me, Gerald?"
"I might be. It all depends on how much you'd be willing to pay for it."
Feingold grunted as though Sir had poked him in the ribs with a rigid finger. He sat back sharply, rearranging himself with some care, and for a moment he did not reply. Then he said, in an entirely different voice,
"I hadn't been aware that you've been undergoing financial reverses lately, Gerald."
"I haven't."
"Then, pardon me if I sound a little confused. Why on earth would you want to..."
His voice trailed off.
"Sell you that little carving?"
Sir finished for him.
"Yes, sell it. I know you've been giving away a great many of the things that Andrew has made. People have told me that it's practically impossible to come here without being offered something. I've seen a few of the things that they've been given. There's never been a question of money changing hands, am I right? And now, completely leaving out of the discussion the fact that I'm not a collector of little wooden carvings, no matter how lovely they might be, you baffle me by asking me if I want to purchase one. Why? I doubt very much that you have any special reason for wanting me to pay for what everybody else gets for free. And you can't possibly need the money. You've just told me that yourself. In any event, how much would you be able to get for an object like this? $500? $1,000? If you're still as wealthy as I know you to be, Gerald, what difference could the odd 500 or 1,000 make to you?"
"Not to me. To Andrew."
"What?"
"Your estimate happens to be right on the mark, John. I think I could get 1,000 for this little thing. And I've been offered rather more than that for chairs and desks that Andrew has made. Not just one-shot purchases, but entire distribution deals for large-scale production. If I had accepted any of the offers, there'd be a fine, fat bank account built up by now entirely on the proceeds of Andrew's woodworking. Something up in the hundreds of thousands already, I suspect." Feingold fussed with his epaulets and collar studs.
"Good heavens, Gerald. I can't make any sense out of any of this. A rich man making himself richer by putting his robot to work in some sort of cottage industry?"
"I've already told you, John, that the money wouldn't be for me. This is all for Andrew's sake."
I want to start selling his products, and I want the money to be banked under the name of Andrew Martin.
A bank account in the name of a robot?
Exactly. And that's why I've asked you to come up here today. I want to know whether it would be legal to establish an account in Andrew's name. An account that Andrew himself would control, you understand. Entirely his own money, which he would be able to use absolutely as he pleases. Feingold said, sounding mystified,
"Legal? For a robot to earn and save money? I just couldn't say. There are no precedents, so far as I've ever heard. I doubt that there's any law against it, but even so, robots aren't people. How can they have bank accounts, then?"
"Corporations aren't people either, except in the most abstract sense. A legal fiction, as you would term it. Yet corporations have bank accounts."
"Well, I grant you that.
But corporations have been recognized in the eyes of the law for centuries as entities qualified to own property of all sorts.
Robots, Gerald, have no legal rights at all, as surely you must be aware. And simply as a procedural matter, let me remind you that corporations also have corporate officers, and they sign the papers that establish the bank accounts. Who would open Andrew's account? You? And would it be Andrew's account if you opened it?"
"I've opened bank accounts in the names of my children," Sir replied. "Nevertheless, the accounts are theirs. Besides, Andrew can sign his name as well as you or I."
"Yes, yes, of course, I suppose you can."
Feingold leaned back until his chair creaked.
"Let me think, Gerald. This is all so unusual. Is there really any legislation specifically forbidding robots to own property, or is it simply assumed that they can't? Because the idea is so far from the mainstream that nobody's ever given a thought to it?" "I'd have to research it before I could give you an opinion. Quite possibly there are no such laws, precisely because a robot having assets is such a peculiar notion that it hasn't been deemed necessary to give it any consideration. Nobody has bothered to pass laws forbidding trees to have bank accounts, after all, or lawnmowers.
Cats and dogs have had bank accounts. Trust funds for their upkeep, left to them by their loving owners," Sir said. "The courts have no objection to that."
"Another good point, yes. Although cats and dogs are living creatures, at least, robots are inanimate."
"I don't see what difference that makes."
"You ought to bear in mind, Gerald, that there's a certain prejudice against robots in our society, a certain fear. I might almost say that doesn't extend to cats and dogs. It might well be that someone has put laws on the books restricting the rights of robots to hold property, but that's easily enough checked."
"Let's assume that it is legal. How would you go about it? Take Andrew down to the bank and let him speak to the manager?"
"I'd simply have the form sent here for Andrew's signature. There shouldn't be any need for a personal appearance on his part. But what I need to find out from you, John, is what I can do to protect Andrew, and myself, I suppose, against negative public reaction. Even though it may well be legal for him to have a bank account, there probably will be people who aren't going to like the idea."
"How will they find out?"
Feingold asked. "How will we keep them from finding out?" said Sir. "If someone buys an item from him and makes a check payable to Andrew Martin, say,
'Yes.'"
Feingold's gaze seemed to turn inward for a moment. Then he said,
"Well, one thing we could do is to set up a corporation to handle all finances in his name. A corporation with a nice impersonal name, something like West Coast Wood Artistry Limited, and Andrew could be the president and sole stockholder, though we could make ourselves members of the board of directors. That will place a layer of legalistic insulation between him and the hostile world. It ought to be enough, Gerald. Whenever Andrew wants to purchase something, he can simply draw a salary from the corporation treasury, or declare a dividend for himself. The fact that he's a robot won't have to be a matter of public record.
The incorporation forms will only need the names of the stockholders, not their birth certificates.
Of course, he'll have to begin filing income tax returns. But the revenue people aren't going to come around to find out whether taxpayer Andrew Martin is a human being or not. All they'll care about is whether taxpayer Martin pays his taxes on time."
"Good," Good. Anything else?
Not that I can think of offhand. If I come up with anything else, once I've run a search for precedents, I'll let you know. But I suspect it's going to work. Nobody's likely to stop you so long as you go about things quietly and obey the absolute letter of the corporation law. And if anyone does find out what's going on and doesn't like it, well, it'll be up to them to take action against you to stop it, provided they can show that they've got legal standing to intervene.
And if someone does, John, will you take the case if a suit is brought against us?
Certainly, for an appropriate retainer.
What would be appropriate, do you think? Feingold smiled.
Something along the lines of that,
he said, and pointed to the wooden plaque.
Fair enough,
said Sir.
Not that I'm a collector, you understand, but it does have a certain artistic appeal.
Indeed it does, said Sir. Feingold chuckled and turned to the robot.
Andrew, you're going to be, well, not a rich man, but a rich robot. Does that please you?
Yes, sir.
And what do you plan to do with all the money you're going to make?
Pay for things, sir, which otherwise sir would have to pay for. It would save him expense, sir.